Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. Driven to Business, where we celebrate the entrepreneurial spirit. We celebrate our successes. We learn from our failures and try to have a good time doing it all. Welcome. We have a great guest with us today. Our guest is Mr. Charlie Wetzel. Charlie is a writer, and Charlie has produced more than 50 books with John Maxwell, one of my favorite authors. And as I finally learned, Charlie's one of my favorite authors. I didn't even know that until meeting him. Charlie, welcome to the Driven to Business.
Well, thank you.
Charlie, you just reading your biography, and I'm quite interested in it. You started off as a chef in New Orleans, Louisiana.
I did.
How does a guy, which sounds like a pretty cool job, actually, how does a guy go from being a chef in New Orleans to writing books with John Maxwell?
Well, my problem was I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, so I really did a lot of jobs. Chef was really the first serious career I had, but I've done so many things. I've worked in the oil patch. I've worked as a teacher. I was a college dean. I've done just about everything in the restaurant business. But I really, I sense that it wasn't the place for me in the long term, because that's a grinding business. It's a really tough one. And I got an opportunity to work for John as his researcher. This is what he was looking for.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I noticed you're also a screenwriter. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. I've been living in the Atlanta area for about 15 years now, and there's a young filmmaker at Whitestone Motion Pictures named Brandon McCormick, and he's the founder of Whitestone. He's a director-producer. And I was the only published writer, full-time writer he knew, so we started having coffee. So we'd have coffee, and we'd talk about stories, and we'd talk about writing process. And I loved their films. They did a lot of short films, and they invited me in to do a story conferences with them, and I contributed. And then he asked me to write a screenplay for a concept that he had called The Candy Shop.
Wow, that's pretty interesting. I can't imagine. I've been trying to write a book for several years, and what I find is I can write about. I've written a bunch of small articles, technical articles, magazine articles, but I find when I sit down to write a book, I get up through about two chapters, and then pretty much I'm out of steam until about a month later when I think of something else. Is that the way books are written? Are you?
I tell you, it's a marathon. It really is. I've run in one marathon in my life, and you know,
that's one more than me.
Well, I tell you what, it becomes a test of character at some point, especially if you're not a great athlete like I'm not. It's really about persistence. When you start, you got to know whether something is an article or a book in terms of sustainability, in terms of the idea. And there are a lot of great ideas out there that are really great articles, but to carry something through to book length, you really have to be persistent. I get a couple chapters into a book, and I feel like it's never going to end, and I'll be stuck in that chair for the rest of my life.
When you were, you have a background in English and a college dean, some other things. Did you, Maxwell, obviously, in his books, you guys focus on leadership, which is a fascinating subject. But did you write about anything else at one time? Were you covering other things interesting you?
You know what? Most of the professional writers that I know, they grew up wanting to write.
Right.
You know, they wrote stories. When I was in graduate school, there was a young woman there who was 21 years old. She had already written four novels and was writing her fifth novel.
Wow.
That wasn't me. God kind of surprised me with the whole writing thing. And I had written because I had to get my English degrees. But the first long piece that I ever wrote was a self-study for a college. And I think every person to become a professional writer has to write their way through some big project that feels too big for them. And that was mine.
You know, you've been very involved with the leadership over at 12 Stone Church, which is a large congregation, for those of you that don't know, here in Atlanta. And you and I had talked earlier about the differences in leadership, perhaps in a church organization, and the difference in leadership in a business organization. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us, first of all, what do you do there at 12 Stone?
I'm on the elder board. I'm the secretary of the board there, and I've done everything that can be done in small groups except be on staff. I've done it one time or another. The majority of my time now I'm spending mentoring younger men in their late 20s, early 30s.
I actually read online an article that you wrote, actually published by the pastor, I think, Dan Ryland, mm-hmm. over there, about the church board and your experience on that. Having served in church leadership myself, I found it very interesting and very helpful article. One of your points in there, in fact, it's your first point, it says that don't step up to a position of leadership in a church unless you're also willing to step down.
Yes.
I found that a very interesting concept.
When the senior pastor, Kevin Myers, invited me onto the board, and our congregation votes to verify that we should be on the board. But when he first talked to me about the idea, he said, Charlie, that the day that the church outgrows your leadership, you've got to step out of leadership. So I've had that mindset from day one that it's a temporary post. And the moment that a better person comes in, or they need a younger person or somebody with a different skill set, I'm content to step down.
You know, I'm trying to relate that to business a bit as well. And you know, in business, many of us that founded businesses find that at least some area of that business at some point begins to outgrow us a bit. Mm-hmm. And perhaps moving, if not outgrow us, at least move into an area where we lack some expertise. I would think the same principle applies there, that there's a time when you need to back out of that and step down and let someone else have it. But I think what stops a lot of us from doing that is ego. Don't you agree?
Mm. I think that does come into play a lot of times, but I think it's also a level of responsibility. I think that the quote unquote point leader, the person who's leading the whole thing, has a different set of responsibilities from the person who's following that person.
Right.
And I think if you're the business owner, to step out, it's another set of circumstances. So I think you've got to bring a team around you, and maybe your role has to change a little bit in those circumstances.
Well, you had mentioned even in the in your article about serving on the board there at 12 Stone, that one of the suggestions you give in your piece there is that people should strive to find a place on that board or a place in leadership, regardless of how a volunteer organization or church is set up, where you actually bring the most value.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I serve on the, in our church, I serve on the finance subcommittee, which is part of what we call a management team at our church. But I joke and kid around with my CPA buddies all the time about how dull they are at parties and so forth, you know. And I don't really consider myself having a lot of skills in the actual accounting side. But you know what? What I do find is that even on a finance committee, everyone on that committee should not be an accountant. There are parts to finance that have nothing to do, like fundraising, for instance, that have nothing to do with being an accountant. And I think that's where you tend to find your skills, perhaps, even though you don't have that specific little small micro skill of accounting, you can bring value to the table.
I agree with that 100%. I think you get invited into the process someplace, and then you've got to figure out where you fit in that process. I don't think it's wise to say, oh, no, I'm going to say no to the whole thing. So, for instance, in terms of finance, I am not a finance guy. I am not a numbers guy. I mean, I can do math, but if you put a dollar sign in front of it, then I get lost.
Right.
But I'm really good at strategy and big picture. So even I could serve in that capacity in something in a finance committee.
And I think it also may be that a person in your position may be better to back away from the trees and perhaps see the forest a little bit, rather than being mired down in the day-to-day grind of finances, which at times can be give you a fairly pessimistic outlook on life, depending on how things are going. And you have got to perhaps be a bit more entrepreneurial and back out and look at that a little different. You know, I've already read some of the things you've written about this, but And I know John Maxwell and several of the books you guys have covered this several times, but there is a different set of skills. Or I'll put it this way. I think it takes more leadership skills to rise to a leadership position in a volunteer organization than it does in a business.
I agree. It's my first leadership experience was as a chef in a kitchen. And to be honest, I was really, really a really poor leader because I didn't like asking people to do anything. So my tendency would either be to do it myself or to bark orders, which nobody likes to be in that kind of environment.
Right.
I really learned to lead in the church. And the thing about the church is everybody's a volunteer. You're a volunteer as a leader, at least I was, and the people I was working with were volunteers. So if you're doing a bad job, they just fade away.
Right.
So you don't have position, you don't have leverage. I mean, if you're a bad leader and you ask somebody to do something and they know their job's on the line, they're going to do it. They may not do it well, but they're going to do it.
Right.
With a volunteer, they're just going to go, I'm going to go someplace else. I'm going to serve somewhere else. This is not working for me.
Yeah, I think particularly in a church, I appreciate what you said about the fact that, you know, you made the comment earlier that you were a poor leader in that area. I have been a poor leader in many areas. But I think one of the things about becoming a better leader is to understand your shortcomings and to admit them.
Yeah.
And not try to hide them because, as I always tell people, you may not be willing to admit your mistakes, but other people see them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can't hide.
So they're there in any case. But we're I do very much buy into what you have written many times about the fact that it takes more leadership skills in a volunteer organization. And perhaps that is a great place for people to hone their leadership skills because it is required. As you said, you know, you can come in and give bark orders at a church board meeting and if they don't like it, they get up and leave. And there really is nothing whatsoever you can do about it.
Yeah. Well, and I started off, I was learning leadership in the church. And at that time, I was the dean of a business college, and wow. I took the leadership I was learning in the volunteer organization, and I brought it into my job, and that's where it was working.
I did the same thing in my company. We'll continue this discussion in just a moment. You're listening to Driven to Business. By the way, we're streaming live on 1190.com. Also, a podcast of today's program will be on eddiemayfield.com. Stick around. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. We are talking with Charlie Wetzel. We're talking about leadership and about business in general. I think I've read every one of John Maxwell and your books. I may have skipped a few, and I think, as I told you earlier, I can get confused about what I read in which book, and you tell me the same thing happens to you.
Yeah, sadly, that's true for me as well at this point.
You know, a number of us have written magazine articles, blogs, things of that sort, but almost none of us have written best-selling books. Well, you have. Let's just pick my favorite John Maxwell book, which I think is one of the best books on leadership ever written, still to this day. It's the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. Walk us through the nuts and bolts. How do you start a book like that? How do you write it?
That one, honestly, was a little bit different from the others. John typically has a concept. He'll say something to an audience, or he'll wake up in the middle of the night with an idea, and he starts to flesh it out. For the 21 Laws, his editor actually came to him and said, I think you need to write a book on the laws of leadership, which was kind of a new idea for John.
Yeah.
But he was really intrigued by that. And this is classic Maxwell. Once he decided he liked the idea, he pulled together into a room 4, 5, 6 really good thinkers and said, okay, let's talk about what could be a law of leadership. And we all came with, I probably had 25, 30 ideas.
Did you start saying we're going to do 21 or did you actually arrive at that?
No, we arrived at that.
Okay.
It took, you know, I think after that day, we probably had about 60.
Yeah.
And we started culling them and it's like, no, you know, that's not true all the time. And no, that's true, but it's not specific to leadership. And these two are really the same thing. Let's combine those and we can say this better. And we went through a process, and I think John probably sat on that list for 2 or 3 months, just fine-tuning the laws, because he wanted to make sure they were really true all the time, and were solid to leadership. So that was the starting point of how that book got birthed.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Let's dig into that book just a little bit here. When I first heard of John Maxwell, he already was well known in California and other parts of the country, but I first heard of John Maxwell attending a Promise Keepers conference out in Colorado Springs many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was very intrigued with him as a speaker. I had read nothing he had written, but I came back and began reading some of his books from that. Whenever anyone mentions John, and I've heard him speak a number of times since then. I really couldn't count the number of times, and I said I've read most of his books.
He's a fantastic speaker.
He is. He's a very good speaker. But whenever anyone mentions Maxwell to me, I think of two things primarily, and I may not be saying is exactly right, but this is the two things I sort of take out of it. Maxwell says a lot of times that leadership is influence, influence is leadership. I think of that a lot.
Yep.
And the second thing is that those that cannot lead are doomed to manage, because I think there was a time when I used to think managing and leading were the same thing.
People used the term synonymously for a long time.
Well, you know, none of us create truth. We discover it. And I think in the books, you and John Maxwell have discovered some truths. How did you, now you already sort of began telling us, but like some of the truths in there, were these intuitive to you, or did you have to study and work on them, or were they intuitive to you?
Well, for me, leadership is very intuitive for John. It is totally not intuitive for me. I am a learned leader, and in some ways, I feel like one of the reasons I'm good working with John is I'm his audience. I'm the person who he talks to. A lot of people who are naturally gifted, and the naturally gifted people, they just get it. But then there are people like me, which I think is true for a lot of people. You go, okay, I am not the person that, you know, that the kids followed on the playground. I wasn't the captain of the football. I played football, but I wasn't the captain of the football team. It doesn't come to me naturally, so I had to learn it. And I've become a student of leadership because I work with John. And good news for me is I'm a student of leadership working for one of the best leadership teachers in the world.
You know, a lot of us, I think, can make the mistake of thinking perhaps that we're better leaders than we are. And that's one reason I think God gives us wives and children and
yes,
and other people to inform us that we're not that good. But, you know, there's one of the 21 laws there in the book is the law of the lid, which is one of the laws is, I have to tell you, has given me a bit of a gut check a few times. Mm-hmm. And, one thing, tell everyone what that law is. And secondly, as a second part of the question, is that a permanent situation? Does the law of the lid apply to you always, or can you grow past that law?
No, you can grow past it. The essence of the law of leadership is that your leadership is the lid on your effectiveness. So whatever you want to set out to do in life, assuming that it's not a solo thing, whatever you want to do, your leadership is going to be the thing that limits you or releases you to achieve. So I think we start off with a mindset of achievement where we want to try to accomplish something, and we get to a point in life, if we're trying to do a lot of things, that we realize, oh, you know, I'm not going to be able to do this by myself. I'm going to need help. I'm going to need a team. I'm going to need other people. And then at that point, that's when you start to feel your leadership lid, and you go, okay, so you can't get people to do anything with you. So you realize, I've got to figure out a way to lead them, to encourage them, to persuade them, to find common goals and try to move the team together. And that's the beginning part of leadership. If you don't cultivate that, you can't get people to work with you.
I think one of the real lessons in my life in founding and starting a business, our company, EMA, we are in a very niche little business, the variable frequency drive business, which most people, I can tell, look on your face, you have no idea what that is.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Most people do not, but it's a very good business. But for those of us, the law of the lid, actually, I began thinking there were earlier days in the company where, honestly, I was almost ready to get out of the business because it seemed like the frustrations of it were more than the business was worth to me at that time. And I came to realize that part of that was because I was micromanaging everything, and I was forcing everything to come through me, mm-hmm. which I will admit is an ego thing. At least it was with me. And fortunately, I was wise enough to get some advice from a couple of consultants and some others that really encouraged me to get out of that and to begin to realize areas where I had shortcomings, where I, in fact, was the lid on the company, and to push those things away from me a bit and put people in positions that knew what they were doing and let them do what they knew to do, and not abrogating leadership responsibilities, but understanding that they also have value and skills, and stepping back, and our company began to grow when I began to do that. And incidentally, not just grow, but it became a lot more fun to be there.
Yeah.
Instead of everything running through me.
Well, and it's funny, what you're talking about is going from a mindset of probably average leadership to good leadership. Where I started was even below that, because the thing that drove me out of the restaurant, I used to tell people, you know, I love food and cooking. It's the people that are killing me. So, you know,
I hear people say that about church, by the way. I love church except for the people that go there.
Yeah. But, you know, I've washed dishes. I've been a waiter. I've been a cook. I've been a chef. And I remember seeing people and thinking, man, it's just, there's, if you've got employees, you've got nothing but people problems. And that's the thing that really intimidated me, because my dream when I was young was to own a restaurant. And then I thought, well, I don't know if I want to own a restaurant. And then I learned leadership in a different context. I realize now, okay, now that I have some leadership skills, I probably could do that, but that's not the dream that I have anymore.
Exactly. And I think the same thing with me was when, I was told an interesting thing by one of the consultants. He said, you know, you value skills too highly. And what he meant by that was that I valued my own skills, technical skill. We're a very technical business. I valued what I saw in people as their value was their technical skills. There's a lot more to life than people's technical skills, and people are a lot more than their technical skills. And when I began learning how to look perhaps at those hidden gems among us, it really began to help us to grow in business and help me to be a lot happier there.
I came from that same mindset too, from a technical mindset instead of a people mindset.
Exactly. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Keep in mind, we are streaming live all over the world on biz1190.com. Podcast of today's program on eddiemayfield.com. Also, contact information for our guest Charlie and so forth on eddiemayfield.com. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around. She was terminally pretty. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. Charlie Wetzel, co-author with John Maxwell, is our guest. We're talking about leadership and about life in general. Charlie, you and John talk about, in some of your books, you talk about myths of leadership. Many of us probably carry a lot of myths or untrue facts about leadership around in our head. And one of them is that the person with the most knowledge is the best leader. Now, I think I used to fall into this trap, actually, but the person with the most knowledge is automatically the best leader. But that's not always true, is it?
No. I came to leadership with that kind of a mindset in the kitchen. Once again, you know, being a chef was my first leadership role. I thought, well, I'm a better cook than these other people. They should follow me. I'm technically really, really good. You should listen to what I say. Well, you know, that doesn't really have anything to do with it, because I had one young woman that worked in the prep kitchen when I was in there, and she told me later, you know, she said, you speak to me like I'm a dog. And Nalu, if you're listening, I apologize, because I was terrible. I was a terrible, terrible leader. But, you know, and you get the same kind of thing in academic circles. You know, you get people who say, well, I've got a PhD. People should follow me. Well, just because you have knowledge doesn't mean that you can get a team to work together or that you know how to work with people.
Exactly. And, you know, another very related myth of leadership is that your position, and it would also apply to your chef position, is that your position, just your position alone, makes you a good leader. Now, you know, that's a tricky one, because in a way, your position does. I mean, if you're being paid to have a leadership position, well, there's some expectations.
Yes,
you do some leading.
Somebody somewhere thought you had the potential to lead.
Right.
If they gave you that position.
Right.
But all they've done is they've opened a door for you. I mean, you still got to walk through that door, and you still got to do it. I think maybe, you know, in our grandparents' generation, somebody who got a title people followed because they said, oh, well, that person's the boss. That's what we're supposed to do. And people worked for companies for 50 years and got the gold watch. That's not the world we live in now. So, you know, someone gives you a position, that's an opportunity. And it's nothing more than that. You've got to earn the rest of it.
Exactly. I think, you know, if you think about a military model of leadership for a moment where rank matters, but if you read great military leaders and read, they led beyond their rank. And there's a saying, a friend of mine that graduated from Annapolis gave me a little thing once. He said that sailors will obey orders, but they will follow leaders. The idea
that's
that,
great. Yeah.
That's and I think that's a very true idea. The kind of leaders that guys, soldiers get up and follow into battle willingly is a very different guy than the guy who just points to the stripes on his arm and says, get out of the ditch. And
People have to follow orders in the military because it's life and death.
Right.
You know, if people don't do what they're supposed to do, then people will die. But it's another thing. I agree with you 100%. My father was 20 years in the Air Force, and I remember him telling me once when I was a kid, he said, you know, I never pulled rank in all the years I was in there. That didn't mean anything to me. Now I understand that. He never once used the clusters on his shoulder to get somebody to do something. He talked to a person like a person and tried to persuade them to do what was the right thing to do.
You know, a guy that I've read a lot and I've heard speak a number of times, and I have a lot of admiration for Jack Welch, at least in his in the leadership area. Jack, I heard him recently speak, and he said that a good leader in an organization, you have got to be willing to be the dumbest guy in the room, which is an interesting thing coming from a guy like him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that shows the power of asking questions.
Right.
Right now, I'm working on a book with John. It'll be his book in. I'll turn it in this fall. It'll come out next year. It's on asking questions, and the whole thing is him answering leadership questions. But there's great power in that.
Another idea that you and John have talked about a lot in your books is that leadership, in many ways. Well, first of all, let's go back to my original premise that leadership is influence. Influence is leadership. Mm-hmm. I buy that completely.
Yes,
on all levels. Whether it's in, in a business situation, it's very common when you're in a sales presentation to a group of people in a business and you're trying to sell them something, and you're doing the presentation to the guy with the title, the head of purchasing or whatever, chief engineer, whatever his title is there. But if you're smart, you begin to try to figure out who the actual leader in that room is. And it's the person with the influence. That's who's the leader. And you try to see who gets listened to when they talk. Yeah. That's the guy you better deal with.
Yeah, if you ask a question, they're waiting for somebody to speak. The person that they look at or the person they're waiting to hear, that's who the influencer is in the room.
And that's a danger even on the selling side of things for thinking that a position automatically equals leadership, but does not. It can be a person with no title at all in that facility, but that really influences all decisions there, and you had better, it will be at your sales peril if you don't deal with that guy and make sure that he's on your board. I remember reading an interesting thing and this was actually, I think John Maxwell had written this in either a blog or an interview, I can't remember, where he said that at the beginning of a book, he would sit down with you and some others, and you guys would just come up with stories and illustrations that were going to be about the book, and you came up with those stories and illustrations before you even wrote the book, which I found kind of interesting.
That's been true some of the time. You know, we're thinking about stories from before the book's written, while the book's being written, even after trying to come up with things. And the reason for that is that, you know, a lot of times you don't remember a principle, but you remember a story.
Yes.
And John honestly was a little bit late to this game. And it was the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership was the first book that we really put the stories in every chapter to illustrate that. John is very, very bottom line. So he judges a book by how many great concepts and great quotes he gets out of it, because he has a method for going through a book and finding the content and doing all that. So, you know, the stories, if they were longer than a few paragraphs, you know, he's ready to move on. So it took some persuading. Now he's 100% on board. We've done this for over 10 years doing the stories. But yeah, we're always on the lookout for good stories, fresh stories. So I've got my antenna up. I'm always reading things. I'm on the internet. I've talked. My wife helps me find stories as well. So yeah, we're always on the lookout for great stories.
You know, as Christians and as active members of churches, you know, Jesus used stories to great effect. In fact, it was apparently his favorite way of teaching.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think there's nothing wrong with using those as examples of story. I've often marveled at the power of a simple story to get a point across that. And I really think a lot of good leaders are able to narrow down complex, perhaps, situations into a very simple thing by simply telling a simple story about it, and all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, I get it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a hallmark of a good teacher and a good communicator. I remember working with somebody who basically tried to communicate everything she'd ever learned about the subject and just throw it in there and gave out notes and then had, you know, 20 pages of extra notes just in case you wanted to look at it later. And I thought, okay, now you're making the listener do all the work.
Right.
You know, you do the work. Try to figure out how to simplify it and make it really, really clear.
You know, we've had, we work around dangerous equipment at times. Some of what we work on is high voltage and things like that. Sometimes when we have a new guy and I would be training him, and I don't do that too much anymore. We have other people that do it. But I would tell them a story about that. I have gone on 3 service calls to replace people that were killed in the equipment. So, you know, you just tell that story. That's a lot. That has a lot more effect than saying, now be careful, this is dangerous, to say, I have been on 3 and tell them some details. This is how these 3 guys got killed in front of me, and I replaced them.
It's making an impression on me, and I'm not even going out in the field.
Well, then I'm having great effect. Bill Hybels, another guy that I admire from his writings and leadership, and he's quoted saying, you're a leader. It's your job to keep your passion hot. Do whatever you have to do. Read whatever you have to read. Go wherever you have to go to stay fired up, and don't apologize to anyone for doing that. Is Bill right?
I think he is. If you take the position, then you take the responsibility. That's one of the things that John really emphasized when I was out at his church in California at Skyline, was that when you become a leader, you give up your rights. If you're out of the organization, if you're out of leadership, you can do anything you want. But as soon as you step in, there are things that you're setting aside that you can no longer do, and your responsibility has got to be the thing that's foremost in your mind. And I think that's what Bill Hybels is talking about there, is taking responsibility. If you're going to lead, never thinking in terms of the perks of leadership, but always thinking of, okay, what do I owe the people that I'm leading, and how can I best do that?
Right. I find that there are things in business you can outsource. And you know, obviously we mentioned accounting, and there are other things you can, as a leader, you can outsource those things to other people and have them done. But passion, I think, as a leader, passion is not something you get to outsource.
Right. John quotes all the time, you know, that a leader can delegate anything except responsibility. I think if you put passion and responsibility, if you lose either one of those, I think you've got to question whether or not you should still be leading, and maybe whether it's time for you to step out temporarily or maybe step down.
You know, interestingly enough, I think the idea of accepting responsibility, I've thought of this many times, is actually empowering in a way. You know, when you can get very frustrated in whether it's in a volunteer organization like a church or in a business or even inside your family, in any situation where things appear to be spiraling out of control and where you seem to be incapable of resolving the problem. I found one of the first ways to resolve the problem is to take responsibility for it. Mm. You know, if I have a bad employee in our company, that is my responsibility. Yeah. It's not someone else's responsibility. And therefore, if I'm the problem, well, then I'm the solution. And that's an empowering thing, because I can now do something about it. Whereas, you know, blaming other people never leads to anything but frustration, even in your own life. It just and I think so many people make the mistake of trying to deflect that by pushing blame on someone else with the somehow that's going to improve their lot, but it never does.
Yeah. Dan Ryland, who's the executive pastor at 12 Stone, said that he was once told by Fred Smith, the consultant, not the FedEx Fred Smith, that if you're the pastor and you've got a staff member who's not doing the job, that's bad stewardship, and you're actually robbing the church.
That's a great way to look at that. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Our great guest today is Charlie Wetzel. We will be back after the break, and stick around. Welcome back to the final segment of this week's Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield, and our guest today is Charlie Wetzel. Charlie, we've been talking about leadership and passion and so forth. You know, one of the things that I mentioned Jack Welch a few moments ago. Welch says one of the deadly sins of leadership is failing to put any fun in the organization. A former pastor of mine, John Bisogno, I was a member at First Baptist Houston for a number of years, he's written several times that growing churches tend to be fun churches. And he doesn't mean that in a sacrilegious way. He just means it tends to be a place where people enjoy each other and enjoy being there. And I find that successful businesses are that way. People enjoy working there. They enjoy their fellow workers. They have fun. The leader of the business is not someone that's always just seen as coming in a cracking whip. He's somebody that's fun to be around.
Nobody really likes to work for somebody who takes himself too seriously.
Right.
I mean, that's what it comes down to. And I think growing churches in that example don't take themselves too seriously. They take the gospel seriously. They take God seriously, but not themselves. I work for a boss who's great at this. John loves to celebrate things. You know, he likes to work hard, but he likes to have a good time. He likes to reward people. He likes to celebrate. I had to marry somebody to get that, because honestly, I'm that guy who takes himself too seriously. And that was part of my problem early in my leadership journey. I had to learn to lighten up. I had to learn to have fun. One of the places I learned this, I led small groups for a lot of years, and I realized, you know, if you don't make it fun, you've just lost half of the people in the world, because they're motivated by being lighthearted and having fun. And if you're not, they're just not going to come.
You know, a guy here in town that is the head of the choral department at Emory University is Dr. Nelson, Eric Nelson. He and I were sitting together at a Promise Keepers conference some years ago. And Eric is, a person with a PhD in music and all this. And so I was curious what he thought about the rather rambunctious music that was going on. And so I was talking about that. And he asked an interesting question. He said, why do you think people sing in choirs? And I told him, I gave him several answers that obviously were crazy, but he said, no, people sing in choirs because it's fun to sing in a choir. And there's no other reason they sing in a choir.
Oh,
and he
great,
said,
yeah.
And he said, if you don't make a choir fun to sing in, people won't come there. And they may not call it fun. They may just enjoy singing harmony. They may this, that, the other. They may give other reasons, but the bottom line on it is that it's fun. I often think about that, because I think that applies to a lot of things in life.
It does.
Fun is a big motivator.
It is. I tell you, the place I've had to learn is with my kids, you know, because I'm trying to give them a head start in life, and trying to be a good father, and trying to, you know, forge ahead and set them on a good course. Cause I, you know, two of them are teenagers, and I've got one who's younger than that, but golly, if it's got to wear them out, if it's not fun. So sounds terrible, but I work hard at trying to have fun.
Charlie, I'm a granddad. So see, we only have the fun side.
That, I hear it gets really good at that point.
that's where we stays there. Let's talk about you for a moment. What's the most fun thing that you do in a year?
Probably the most fun thing I've done in the last year, I took my three kids and my wife, and we all went to England.
Wow.
I traveled to England once or twice a year. I've done that for 6-7 years. And I go over and I do some consulting work with churches and leadership in small groups. And I volunteer for EQIP, which is John Maxwell's nonprofit, and do some training with pastors over there with that. But when I love England. I've got great friends over there that I love to see. There's another church over there that I feel like is my second church home. And I've taken my family with me three or four times. My youngest went to England for the first time before she was 2 years old.
Wow.
So that to me is a blast, traveling with the family and going over there.
We enjoy traveling. Our family every year, and we do it at Labor Day. We do what we call the kids' name of this year. All of my kids are married and have children now, so we're a pretty good sized group when we go. But they began calling it family camp, and we do that every year over Labor Day. We usually go to Hilton Head and rent a giant house because there's a ton of office these days, and we just spend the weekend having fun. And it is a lot of fun. I'll just go ahead and give you a preview here. You're just entering the world of teenagers, and yeah. You're going to need a sense of humor to get through that.
I already do. there are a lot of days when you just have to laugh because you get too frustrated.
But that's part of it. I think keeping a bit of an attitude, a bit of a fun attitude about that, and just enjoying. And it's the same thing. Even I think in business with employees, you really need. Employees are, I'm going to mess up occasionally. Employees are going to mess up. They just are. And there's times when you might as well just laugh about it and say, boy, you know, we blew that.
For most of us, it's not life and death.
Right.
Now, you talked about working with some men who are working in high voltage situations. Well, that is life and death. But you're not around high voltage every minute of the day.
Right.
You know, sometimes you just have to go, you know what? There are more important things than this one that I'm dealing with right this moment.
Charlie, you've had a very successful and a very varied career. I'm kind of envious of it in a way. But what should we expect from Charlie Wetzel in the future? What do you have going on now?
Well, I'm going to continue writing with John until he's done writing, I think. And
I think he'll be in the grave when that happens. Pretty sure.
Well, you know, he said he was going to slow down. Now he's going twice as fast as he ever was. So John is very entrepreneurial, very opportunity driven, and I think he feels that God's put him here for a purpose, so he's trying to fulfill that. I'm on board for the long haul for that, to help him with what God's called him to. I've just written a book with Kevin Myers and John called Home Run. And I'm still doing some things with Whitestone Motion Pictures. They're trying to get their first feature film off the ground. And
what is Home Run about? What's that? What is that?
Home Run is about how we tend to live life backwards. Most people focus entirely on their career, and they make that the end all and be all. And
right. You
know, they get a certain way in there, and they realize, oh, you know, I've really neglected relationships. And you look at how many business people burn a marriage or two.
Right.
Alienate their kids because they put the career in front of everything else. And then they realize that there are more important things in life. So they try to go back and repair relationships with the people that they love. And then they have a hard time doing that because they realize they've neglected some character issues. And then when they go after those character issues, then God starts to stir them. They realize they end up going to God to help them with that. And if they just realize that they'd gone to God first and then repaired their character and then developed their relationships, their career would have taken care of itself and they could fulfill purpose. So that's what Home Run's about.
That's like a book I'd like to read, actually. It's a very, very, very interesting book. Hey, listen, hindsight being 2020, and as I also say sometimes, hindsight's also, for most of us, quite useless because it's in the past and we can't do anything about it. But is there anything in your career that you would do differently if you had the chance to do it again?
I took a lot of dead-end roads early in my career, and I've done so many things. I sold cars for a year, for instance. Now, that was one of the worst jobs I ever had. It was also one of the best jobs I ever had because I really had horrible people skills, and I felt like it was God's way of helping me to sit down and be able to talk to people and relate to people and have conversations. So it's a skill set that I sorely lacked and desperately needed. So as many mistakes as I've made and as many dead-end roads I've gone down, you know what? I have to say, because of the things I learned, I wouldn't change it.
I think, isn't it true that it's often during the, I don't mean selling cars being a dark time. I'm not trying to quite go that dramatic with it. But,
it was.
The idea that we do learn from the hard times, don't we? More than often than we do from the good times.
Absolutely. I think I probably learned more during the times that I was unemployed than any other time. In my life, because there are so many lessons to learn, and because it's rough, you really discover what's important and what's not.
You know, before I took the job that with two entrepreneurs in Texas that taught me the business I'm in now, I was unemployed for a time. And I really think, and I've said this a number of times, being unemployed made me a much better employee because I was so happy to have a job and a paycheck.
Yes.
They got 110% out of me because, I was absolutely living that up. In a very short time, 15 seconds, how do you want to be remembered?
As someone who helped other people find their purpose and fulfill it.
That's a great mission. Charlie, thank you so much for being here today. You're a great guest.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
You've been listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Keep in mind, we are a podcast of today's program. We'll be on eddiemayfield.com. Of course, we are carried live every week on biz1190.com. Thank you for being here, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.